This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and our show is called Main Street because these microphones are our virtual Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. Those real Main Streets that we love to cross and say hello to our friends and acquaintances as we greet them on the street, well, those are important too, because that's where we stop and chat, maybe, once we get out of the middle of the street and talk about, you know, what's on our minds, chew the fat a little bit. And today, we're going to talk with somebody who loves to talk because that's kind of his business, along with critical thinking. Jack Russell Weinstein is a UND philosophy professor and the host of Why, Philosophical Discussion about Everyday Life, which you can hear on Prairie Public's radio network, 5 o'clock this Sunday. The show is coming up. It's once a month. And Jack, what's the topic this week?
The topic is why human beings, or Homo sapiens, evolved into artists. It was an incredibly interesting topic and something that once the question was posed, I thought, I have absolutely no answer to this.
Well, you brought in an expert, Valerius Geist, professor emeritus in environmental science from the University of Calgary. Why him?
He is an expert on what's called environmental design, but he's also done a lot of research on wolves and North American mammals. And so he has a very strong sense of both the evolutionary process, but how the evolutionary process interacts with animals and living things and how living things in general respond to the geography, the climate, and other things. I actually learned about him from one of our earliest guests, a guy named Larry Cahoon, or Lawrence Cahoon, who he was our second guest, and he did an episode called The Philosophy of Hunting. He's a hunter, and we talked about that. He sent me an email. He said, you should try Valerius Geist. He is one of those guys that know everything. and I see no evidence to the contrary. He was a great guest.
Well, you say very provocatively in your introduction, if we didn't have art, we couldn't be called human. And let's dissect that a bit, because you dissect with Dr. Geist human. Homo sapiens is the distinction you make, right?
That's absolutely right. I asked him about evolution, and I always had the sense that evolution was a straight progression, right? That we were amoeba or what have you, and then made our way through monkeys and then poof, human beings. But in fact, what he told me was that the Neanderthals and the Homo erectus lived at the same time. And we ended up becoming from the Homo sapiens who defeated, or outlived the Neanderthals. And one of the reasons was that Homo sapiens were able to think about novelty. They're able to be creative and change their environment. And that turns out to be the origin of art. And so the simplest answer to the question, why did human beings survive? Why did Homo sapiens beat Neanderthal? The shocking answer is because Homo sapiens were capable of making art.
So it sounds like art is pretty important to humans in terms, not just, you know, some spatter painting by Jackson Pollock, but actually inventing things.
Absolutely. One of the things he pointed out late in the conversation was that dog breeds are a form of art, right? We have this vision of what a dog should be and what a dog should be able to do. And because of that, we're able to breed them and train them and over many generations create this thing that never existed before, right? There was no purebred border collie 100,000 years ago. That was an invention probably of Scotland or that area anyway, and shepherds. And human beings could not have evolved into shepherds if the dogs didn't evolve with us. So that's a very basic example of something we don't necessarily think of as art. But once you point to, you know, the Westminster Dog Show as an example of the finest art in dog, it makes perfect sense.
Okay, well, let's talk about something that precedes dog breeding, and that is cave drawings and carved artifacts. What do they tell us about art and humans?
Well, the first thing is they show us that human beings had what Geist calls abundance, meaning they weren't desperate. They weren't necessarily in survival mode. They had time to think about the things that weren't necessarily in front of them. And the two things that the cave painters had in mind were dead relatives or ancestors and objects of prey, so reindeer. And they had this notion that if they could paint it, they could have it. So they would paint the reindeer and hunt the reindeer and then give homage to the ancestors as a way of remembering. And they actually felt that there's evidence to suggest that they thought that the ancestors were deep inside the cave. Mm. And so by providing art onto the cave, by putting art onto the cave, they're able to communicate to their ancestors who they owe great debts to.
And because they now live in groups and because they do things in groups, so maybe hunt and feed themselves and do other things, they have developed time, as you mentioned earlier. And time gives us moments to think.
Absolutely. We take that for granted. We take for granted the idea that we can sit even at a stoplight and reflect on our day or drive around annoyed at, you know, whatever happened at work that week. But that is actually a luxury because no one's trying to kill us or we're not starving to death. And so we begin to think of these moments of reflection as time, but something else happens, which is that we have to keep this abundance up. We have to keep this security. And the way to do that is to be able to plan the hunt. The only way to plan the hunt, Homo sapiens realized, was to be aware of the reindeer migration. The way you become aware of the reindeer migration is by looking at when they migrate. You have to invent a calendar, and you invent a calendar by looking at the moon. And so then you are prepared for the migration, and you are able to kill more reindeer, have more food, be more secure, and have this abundance. And you couldn't do that if you didn't develop the sense of time. Again, think about, in terms of art, think about the calendar in front of us, right? Think about the columns and how there are 7 days to the week and the fact that the names of the days and months are named after originally gods and goddesses. And that's incredibly creative. And we couldn't have a birthday. We couldn't have a month. We couldn't have a week. We couldn't have any of that stuff if we weren't able to think about what isn't in front of us. And that, again, is art.
So it's important to think about what we now consider as practical. You give the example of a calendar, started as something remarkably creative.
Absolutely. All the things that we think of as practical are remarkably creative. Sneakers, a hairbrush, the microphone that I'm talking into, right? There's elements of design in everything. If the microphone looked completely different from the way it looks to me now, if it wasn't cylindrical, if it wasn't hanging in front of my face, and of course we're on the radio so people can't see it, but they'll have to take my word for it, I would have a different relationship with the microphone. Everything we do, water bottles also in front of me, our keychain, even our underwear, right? This is all a matter of design. This is all a matter of incredible creativity that we take for granted because it becomes so common that it just feels like, well, these things were always there.
Well, this is sort of the core of a meaty discussion that you have this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central Time on Prairie Public's radio network and why philosophical discussions about everyday life, because you look at the institution where you work, the University of North Dakota, and talk about the debate in higher education over practical or career-oriented subjects versus creativity and critical thinking, those other subjects.
You know, one of the things that becomes obvious when you look at times of economic stress or times of people consolidating power is they want the things that they don't want to give other people. And so there is great debate now as to whether or not the University of North Dakota is going to fund art classes and music classes and other of these creative, less, you know, let's call it job-oriented professions. However, what's the first thing that a new administrator does? He or she redecorates their office. They get suits and ties. They get a haircut. They present themselves in a way that's professional. They put art on the wall. Their whole presentation of what it means to be a successful, professionalized administrator is dependent on the art that they absorb as symbols. This actually goes back to the Homo sapiens in that one of the things that tribes did in order to identify status was create jewelry and body painting. The more jewelry you had, the higher status you had. Why would you want higher status? Because it's easier to eat. You have more food. So the necktie, the power suit, the pantsuit, these are just direct descendants of the body painting and jewelry from hundreds of thousands of years ago. It is still an absolute necessity to absorb and surround ourselves by art in order to project who we are.
Well, a lot of what's taught at a university like UND started as a creative idea. Let's, have the art of medicine or the art of law, and then we will, categorize it and make it into something that we can practically teach. So the conundrum here seems to be that a higher education institution can emphasize the practical, and yet the creative is always going to be changing that.
That's absolutely right. And the creative is often invisible, right? You sit in class and you're thinking about anatomy, right? Let's say you want to be a doctor, incredibly important thing to be. And you ask yourself, well, why is the kidney here? What if the kidney were there? That's an artistic and critical thinking process. Why should human beings be this weight instead of that weight? Is obesity just a health issue? Is it a beauty issue? Do we think it's unhealthy because our culture doesn't particularly like it? What about, one of the signs that when we have friends who are going through chemotherapy, they lose their hair? And some people wear wigs and some people wear bandanas and some people just go out without any hair on them. And these are all incredible aesthetic questions that are deeply ingrained in the critical evaluation of what it means to be healthy. How do you present yourself as a healthy person and as a person who other people want to be around? And so part of what I say in the introduction is that this division between practical and creative, once you start really looking at it, it doesn't make any sense because all the businesses who want new employees, they want employees who can write well. Well, writing well is a creative activity. They want employees who are entrepreneurial and innovative. Entrepreneurship and certainly innovation are creative activities. So anyone who makes that radical division and who says, well, we are just going to focus on the things that get students job, they're not paying attention to what the jobs involve, and they're certainly not paying attention to what it means to be a human being.
Well, evolution and that discussion you had with Valerius Geist at the University of Calgary, that's one expression of change over time. That's a long period of time typically. But when change is rapidly accelerated, like it is these days, what does that suggest about creative expression?
Well, that's a really interesting question because, first, the way that Dr. Geist describes evolution is figuring is creating a way to solve a problem that human beings couldn't solve. If they can't solve any problems, they don't evolve. And he actually thinks that human beings right now are stagnant, that we are not evolving because we have culture and technology that solves all of our problems. If something happens that we can't deal with, then our bodies will change. Once you get involved in culture, then change happens much more rapidly, but the change is less fundamental. I say this during the interview. One of the weird things about talking about evolution is that you are talking about massive periods of time, hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years, and yet you're talking about learning how to bend your thumb or learning how to use a stick as a tool, right? This massive amount of time for this itty bitty little change that adds up to these tremendous changes. What cultural change is these non-fundamental, non-foundational behaviors that can change quickly because they are a product of our creativity, of our art. All cultural change is artistic change. All cultural change is a response to not a necessity per se, but rather a new feeling, a new idea, a new desire, a new want. And that can change much quicker because that's not at the moment an evolutionary process, although maybe in 500,000 years we will see it as such.
Well, Doctor of Philosophy, Jack Russell Weinstein, which came first, the artist or the scientist, or were they the same thing?
I asked a similar question to Val, And he basically said that science is a form of art. The way that he described it is he's looking at all this evidence that people have put in front of him, and he thinks about it and reflects on it. And then he says, then I have a eureka moment. I have an idea. I learned something. I have a thought that no human being has ever had in the history of human beings. It's a novel thought. And all scientists have that, all authors. Stephen King writes a book, right? And that book never existed before. Those sentences, those words in that order never existed before. That particular monster never existed before. The same thing of a television show, right? So scientists are like authors and like actors in the sense that when they develop a new idea, it's something that never existed. And that's the product of artistic creative activity. And so he really sees science as a subset of art in the grand sense.
Well, art in the general society is sometimes looked at as a luxury. Perhaps it's being looked at as a luxury by the UND administration right now. But it sounds to me like you're making the argument, and Professor Geist as well, that art is an absolute necessity.
I am certainly making that argument. He, being a scientist, is very reluctant to make moral claims. And I ask him, and we have a whole discussion as to whether or not you can look at evolution for any kind of moral message, right? We talked about how human beings killed animals. And then I said, well, if being a Homo sapien is about killing certain animals, then does that mean that vegans aren't human beings? And we have a whole conversation about that. He's very reluctant to make those kind of claims. I, however, am not reluctant. I think both in my personal experience and from the vast amount of things that I learned from this particular conversation, I think that art is an absolute necessity. And anyone who thinks otherwise, they just need to reflect a little bit, because we can take it on the simplistic level and say, what would life be like without the radio? What would life be like without the windows to look out on the prairie? What would life be like without clothes that you think reflect your personality? But more importantly, and this is from the evolutionary perspective, what would life be like if you couldn't think things might be other than they are? Let me just very quickly explain what that means. You're sitting listening to the radio right now, and you're thinking, I wish I had a sandwich in front of me. And then you think, well, after I'm done listening, I am going to create a situation in which there's a sandwich in front of me. That's novelty. That's the ability to think about the world other than it is. If we just thought about the world as it was, we'd just stare at the desk wishing there was a sandwich.
Well, that's
and
a pretty,
that is art.
Well, that is a pretty practical way to look at art. Thank you, Jack Russell Weinstein.
Thank you, Doug. It's always a pleasure.
Jack's show, Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, airs at 5 p.m. Central Time this Sunday on Prairie Public's radio network. Tom Ezer is next.
Support is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
And by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity for 2.8 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to the Mexican border.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and he's a pretty good writer, too. He writes the Plains Folk essays, and he voices them for us here on Main Street. Today, his essay is titled Something to Remember.
3 years ago, my Suzanne and I were honored to be artists in residence at the Wallace Stegner House in East End, Saskatchewan. We did some good writing that summer. Suzanne took Wally's upstairs bedroom as her office, while I set up shop in Hilda's dining room. Wallace Stegner, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and the dean of Western Letters, spent key years of his boyhood, about a century ago, here in East End. We're great fans and close students of his memoir, if you can call it that, Wolf Willow, a work we have taken apart and put back together again countless times. During this and other sojourns in East End, we have dined on many occasions in Jack's Cafe, a well-known establishment dating from the origins of the town, run by generations of Greek proprietors. Above the counter hangs a portrait of the Parthenon. I have no doubt that this Greek establishment contributed to the titling of Wolf Willow's final chapter as False Front Athens. Stegner's most ardent admirers have a hard time with this chapter, wherein he considers the possibilities of life in a country town like East End. He concludes it was a pretty good place to be a boy, but not a place where a thinking person could live a rewarding adult life. There is a lot of ambivalence in the chapter, but in the end, it comes off as patronizing at best. Stegner assesses his old hometown in line with his general assumptions about life on the plains. He lived his boyhood on what he considered the last frontier, where the ideal of progress reigned. In retrospect, Stegner questioned all that and embraced what scholars like me have come to call the declensionist narrative. On the plains, we have fashioned a legend of failure, come to think that our best days are behind us, and embraced the belief that our region is in a permanent state of decline. The declensionist narrative poses all sorts of problems for plains folk who may never have heard the scholarly phrase, but have lived the arc of its narrative. How do you maintain social capital, hold communities together, and live satisfying lives in a declensionist country? Now, the paragraphs I just shared with you are the beginning of Chapter 5 of my current book project entitled Pacing Dakota. The chapter goes looking for the strands of community in what I am calling the post-rural plains. It also introduces an idea I am calling the community of memory. Along the way, I think I come to understand something about Wallace Stegner and other scholars and writers who have trouble imagining themselves in prairie communities. I realize now why the final chapter of Stegner's Wolf Willow, False Front Athens, is a painful disappointment. Stegner returned, in middle age, to the place of his boyhood on a quest of personal identity. This is a life development thing, the uneasy middle age contemplation of identity. He emerged to say, "I may not know who I am, but I know where I came from." Good enough, we may say. Prowling the paths of his youth, however, the middle-aged Stegner did not fully engage. He tried to remain incognito, to sleuth around town in search of informants and documentation without re-entering the community. He remained aloof from the community of memory. Memory is the basis for community in prairie towns. Conversely, it takes a community to sustain memory as anything meaningful beyond the personal, trivial, or antiquarian. And that's something to remember.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, we'll have a report from Montana Public Radio about wildfires in that state. Then Dave Thompson, our news director, will come by to talk about the week's big stories, as he does every Friday. And Friday is the day that Matt Olean reviews a new movie, and this week it's Detroit, 50 years after the riots that rocked that city. First, though, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's insurance commissioner says health insurance companies are wondering if the CSR payments from the federal government will continue. CSR stands for cost-sharing reductions. It's part of the Affordable Care Act. Insurance companies get direct payments to help low-income people cover the costs of coinsurance and deductibles. President Trump has threatened to withhold those payments after attempts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act have failed.
It's kind of our stance that those CSRs should be continued to help, again, provide some stability to our marketplace going forward until until we can implement whatever changes Congress wants to make.
State Insurance Commissioner John Gottfried says insurance companies have built their rates on the assumption that they will get those CSR payments.
To now kind of pull the rug out from under them here in the last couple months of the year and then even into the next year, it makes it tough to plan. It makes it tough to set, you know, what is 2018 going to look like?
Gottfried says without those payments, insurance rates could go up 12% to 15% just on the cost shares alone. He says the three insurance companies in North Dakota, Sanford, Blue Cross, and Medica, have already submitted their rates for the upcoming year, but Gottfried says he's now asking them for more information about what would happen if the CSR payments go away. A milestone for the city of Minot. As Prairie Public's Dave Thompson reports, a ribbon-cutting ceremony was held today for a flood protection project for the city's water treatment plant.
This could be counted as the first phase of Minot's recovery from the 2011 flood. Its water treatment plant is now protected by flood walls, the first flood walls of its kind in Minot, and the first Minot flood protection that has been done since well before the 2011 flood. This is designed to keep a clean water supply in times of flood. During the 2011 flood, residents were ordered to boil water at least twice. This is the first of several phases. The next phase will be some other flood wall projects. And the fourth phase of the project is going to be a diversion that they're calling the Maple Diversion. For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson in Minot.
And so far, 2017 has been a good year for road construction progress projects across the state.
At the end of July, we were sitting at about 33% completed, which compares exactly to the same a year ago. Much like last year, we had a good run of weather in the middle of the summer that helped push it along. And it's actually from 2015, we're at 20%. So we had a good start or midpoint to the construction season here.
Wade Swenson is the director of the State Transportation Department's Office of Operations. He says you can attribute that to drier weather.
Exactly, with the contractors, with their paving, seal coat operations. I mean, obviously, without having rain delays, they're able to get more completed.
Swenson says there is still a lot of work to do.
You know, it's amazing, you know, this time of year, we'll start seeing a lot of this percentage go up fairly quickly because they're paving and doing those bigger ticket items that will actually start coming off the board, and you'll see that percentage rise fairly quickly.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, there's that familiar sound in the background, that wire machine from years ago, and Dave Thompson and I remember it vividly.
Boy, do we ever.
Dave is our news director by our microphone in Bismarck. Dave, I hope you're having a reasonably good day.
A reasonably good day. Well, there's been a few frustrations, but we won't go into it.
Very good. Well, let's talk about something that's happening to the west of you. On Wednesday, Missoula County's health department made the unprecedented recommendation that an entire town in Montana's Seeley Lake evacuate because of pollution from wildfire smoke. Eric Whitney of Montana Public Radio has more on where that recommendation came from and how it's being received.
Russ James has lived in Seeley Lake for 60 of his 61 years. He's got a house about 4 miles out of town, and when I caught up with him in the grocery store parking lot, he said the town has heard the health department's recommendation that everyone who can should leave Seeley Lake to protect their health.
And I think all of us really appreciate the warning, but not all of us are going to leave.
The county says, look, this is really bad for your health. You should go. But you're saying there's no way I'm leaving. Why not?
I've got 61 good years in now. I mean, that's it. I don't know that the next week is going to make that big a difference. If I leave and the place burns down, people steal all my stuff, then, yeah, that would make a difference. This isn't that bad.
Air quality specialists like Sarah Cofield disagree. Cofield works for Missoula City County Health. She says she understands that some people aren't going to like hearing her department's recommendation to leave, but it's based on air pollution readings like they've never seen before.
What's happening in Seeley Lake is really serious.
Air quality monitors across the state measure pollution based on the number of tiny particles per cubic meter of air. Healthy air has 12 micrograms of particles per cubic meter. This morning, Cofield said,
the air is unhealthy in Missoula right now. It's about 80 to 85. It is more than 10 times worse than that in Seeley Lake.
And it's been that bad in Seeley Lake for 7 of the first 10 days of August, frequently hitting peaks near 1,000 micrograms per cubic meter. And it's only abating to healthy levels for an hour or two each day, if that. It's that cumulative impact, Cofield said, that prompted the health department to recommend that people should leave Sealy Lake or at least try to sleep somewhere else, since the smoke is typically at its worst overnight. She says it was a consensus decision made by a team that included a physician and public health and air quality specialists.
We realized that we have a responsibility as a health department to give people the very best advice that we can and respond to what we are seeing.
On Wednesday, the Red Cross put a shelter for people fleeing smoke on call southeast of Sealy Lake in Potomac. As of this afternoon, no one was using it. Tonight, Cofield is addressing a public meeting in Sealy Lake about the fire situation. She says unhealthy smoke levels could last for a while.
We are going to be recommending people not sleep in Sealy Lake until the Rice Ridge Fire stops filling the valley with hazardous levels of smoke. That may be until the fire is out. It may be until the fire moves to a different part of the wilderness and isn't quite positioned to send its plumes straight down the Morrell Creek drainage anymore. It's a little bit up in the air right now. But right now, it's going to be in effect for the foreseeable future this wildfire season.
In Sealy Lake, I'm Eric Whitney, Montana Public Radio.
Well, Dave, our only complaints, I guess, about the wildfires to the west and to the north of us in Canada is that, you know, it creates wonderful sunsets.
But yes, it does.
We don't have that particular problem yet, but we do have a drought in North Dakota. We have dry conditions.
We certainly do.
And the potential for grass fires and other things.
I'm beginning to wonder if that might be the case here, if we might have to do that depending on the dryness of the air and the dryness of the ground and how these particles get into the air. But this is something new to me. I had not heard of this before. But, you know, air pollution control situations and monitors are getting a lot more, sophisticated. So I can see why there would be an alert, especially if you are asthmatic or have other breathing problems.
Well, I can remember, it's now decades ago, but when Mount St. Helens blew up, we had ash in Fargo-Moorhead.
I remember, too. I was in the Grand Forks, and we had ash in Grand Forks. And as a matter of fact, one noontime, it looked like it was about dusk because of the ash in the air.
Let's talk about another kind of air pollution. Amy Sisk had a story this week headlined, Battle Brews Over Methane Leaks.
Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, that we have the federal government who, under the Obama administration, was trying to really get a control of methane leaks. And there's been some industry pushback that they want to make sure that, you know, we only deal with the most egregious examples, perhaps. So that's one worth watching, I think, to see what happens and to see what the new administration is going to do.
Well, Scott Pruitt, the EPA agency head, was in the state. He had a closed-door meeting with the state's political leaders, and he was actually here to talk about waters of the U.S., among other things. But
he was at the Energy and Environmental Research Center at UND, too,
so
to talk about carbon capture.
What are we to make of him having a closed-door meeting?
Since I'm an open meetings, open records advocate, it bothers me some. I understand why he did it, and I don't understand why he was allowed to do it.
Well, why did he do it? Explain for our listeners.
He does it because, you know, there's a whole thing about you. If you're going to have people free with information, then the press gets in the way. Hello, this is democracy, and you work for us.
Okay.
So this whole Scott Pruitt thing raises a lot of questions in my mind about, are these things, these closed-door meetings, improper? And as a side note, because agencies do have the authority to go into closed meetings if they have dealings with an attorney or something like that, you know, attorney-client privilege, there are at least a couple of attorneys around who I have talked to cover the Capitol, like I cover the Capitol for news, and they say they think maybe they should take another look at that. They think there might be too many closed meetings. I'd not heard that before, but I think it's worth exploring.
Well, that's music to our ears.
Yes.
Okay.
Because we believe in openness, yes.
Absolutely. You filed a story earlier this week, headlined, State Human Service Centers Trying to Eliminate Wait Lists. Wait lists are dangerous for this particular activity.
Very dangerous. If you think about calling to get an appointment and they'll say, well, we can put you on next Thursday. The studies have shown in the North Dakota Human Services Department that a lot of these people don't come back. They don't come and seek treatment. But if they're setting what they're doing is setting aside a couple of days per week where you can just come in and you can be screened, and then you can be assigned to a therapist if you need to, or some kind of treatment. And they're working with private providers to help with this. And instead of, you know, waiting 3 or 4 days, you go in 1 day and you're probably done in 1 hour to 2 hours.
Well, again, it's very dangerous to tell an addict to wait.
It sure is. And they know that. And Human Services Department has said that they think they're getting better. But even they said that if they had a grade to give themselves, they'd give themselves a B- to C+. But they're still rolling out and they're still hoping that more and more of these days can be set aside and more treatment can be secured quickly.
Another story you had earlier this week was headlined, State Budget Cushion Will Be Larger Than Expected.
Now, this is interesting because remember what the legislature had to do? They had to drain the budget stabilization fund. And there was a thought that the way the state's budget is, it's not going to fill up. Well, when the ending fund balance gets to $65 million, money over that amount will start flowing into the budget stabilization fund. And now, according to Pam Sharp, our budget director, it looks like that's going to happen. So it was better than expected.
Well, that is good news. And we could use some.
We can use some good news, yes.
Another story. You were always busy, and of course you were unusually busy this week too. The Public Service Commission is going to hold hearings on alleged violations of the Dakota Access Pipeline siting permits. What kinds of violations are we talking about?
All right, and let me tell you about the hearing. The hearing is more of an investigation into these violations to see if there's room to actually have a complaint. There will be a hearing on Thursday, and it's going to deal with clearing away too much brush and trees. The Public Service Commission sets a standard when you're digging a pipeline. You can only use so much of the corridor. Well, the staff is alleging Dakota Access cleared a lot more trees than they needed to and a lot more brush than they needed to. So they're looking at that because that would be a violation of the permit they received, the siting permit.
That's kind of a stupid question that rises in my head when I hear that, Dave. Why would that just be kind of discovered recently? Wouldn't that happen while they were building it?
Well, that's a good question because the Public Service Commission hires a third-party contractor, and it's the third-party contractor who reported this. And I don't know how widespread this is. I think that's going to be coming up in the hearing on Thursday.
Okay.
At the same time, there's another potential complaint, and that is about the rewriting of a pipeline to go around some artifacts. The Public Service Commission has issued a show cause order on that, and it's been the subject of some closed meetings, as we talked about earlier, where they had discussions with their attorneys, and they're trying to come away with some idea about what the next steps are going to be there.
So when the PSC has a closed-door meeting with its attorney, that suggests that some sort of settlement might be in the works.
Right, except they've had three, and there's a story that I will have Monday morning just to lay this all out. And so far, according to a Public Service Commission source, they have not been able to reach settlement with the company.
Okay, stay tuned.
Yes, interesting.
This one caught my eye, Dave, headlined Interim Tax Committee Looking at Property Tax Business Tax Incentives.
Mm-hmm. Property tax and business tax incentives. A committee that's going to have nothing to do in the interim, right? I mean, they're going to go and delve into property taxes. And it's based on the legislature's decision to take over the social service funding. And then this idea that you set aside a property tax relief fund is going to go away. They're going to provide property tax relief by taking over those county-run social service programs that are mandated programs in the state. So they said it's now time to really take a look at the whole property tax system. And the chairman of that committee, Senator Jessica Unruh from Beulah, even brought up the idea of personal property tax.
That's what got my attention.
That's, I think it was the 1960s, there was an initiated measure to get rid of it.
Yeah, that's it's a very interesting tax because it requires a personal visit.
Right. And that one of the reasons they got rid of the personal property tax is it is so hard to come up with a number. Because what do you count and what don't you count? And can you get in? Can you visit? There's all sorts of things there, but Senator Unruh said other states are taxing it, and she said we might just take a look at it and see what the pros and cons are.
A lot of
things are on the table.
Another issue that I just kind of was made aware of, because we've got all these teacher contract negotiations going on, and of course the property tax has always been that fundamental piece of school funding.
Right.
But the complication now is that the state is providing, let's say, 70% of that property tax
support. More like 83%.
Well, what that means is that the local school board has very little flexibility in terms
of making
a decision about contracts.
And one thing that school boards will tell you is that sometimes they rely on the properties to increase, property values to increase. Well, in the Bismarck School District, for example, not expecting property tax or the property values to increase very much this time. So there's no wiggle room there. So you can say we did not raise the mill levy, but they're collecting more in property taxes because your property value went up. Well, it doesn't look like it's going to happen too much this time.
Well, it happened to me last year.
Yes.
So I guess it's the luck of the draw.
I think so.
We've got one more story here, Dave. This is at your alma mater. The core library expansion is completed and under budget.
This is a fun story only because you think of a library as something else. And this core library, they take core samples when they drill for oil, and they keep them in a library. And I want to go back, and I've been invited to go to the core library and tour it. And a phrase I want to use in my news story is, this is more valuable than a box of rocks.
That's for sure. 85 miles of core.
Exactly.
In 150,000 boxes. I hope that's a good foundation.
I think it might be.
that's some heavy reading there.
That sure is.
Okay. Well, it's always a pleasure to talk with our news director.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Dave Thompson joins us every Friday on Main Street. Coming up next, Matt Olien reviews the new movie, Detroit, 50 years after the riots.
Jason Isbell is one of the hottest tickets this summer, and Prairie Public would love to give you a pair. Just make a pledge of any amount at prairiepublic.org and you'll automatically be entered to win two tickets to see Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit, along with Frank Turner, Tuesday, September 5th at Blue Stem Amphitheater in Moorhead. No pledge is required to enter, but we hope you'll take this moment to support the station that brings you so much musical discovery, including Jason Isbell before the world was hip to him. Help Prairie Public help you discover even more amazing artists with your pledge of support. Deadline to enter is midnight, August 18th at prairiepublic.org.
Maybe we'll get 40 years together. One day I'll be gone.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
The fanfare says it all. It's time to talk about the movies with Matt Olien. And this week, Matt, you went to a movie that has some historical relevance for those of us of a certain age.
Detroit. Director Catherine Bigelow, who, of course, did The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. And, you know, Doug, it almost feels like the third of an American trilogy that she's done here, really on these kind of events in American history, although Hurt Locker is not based on real events. It's based on the war in Iraq, but certainly Zero Dark Thirty and Detroit are based on actual events. And she has a gift. The only other director I can think of is Paul Greengrass, who can pull this off. And it's a gift for shooting scripted material, but it kind of looks like it's newsreel. It almost looks like you're there, like it's happening. And that's a hard thing to pull off in movies. And she does it again here with Detroit. Now, it's about the riots of 67, as you know, Doug, racial riots in Detroit. And specifically, the centerpiece of the film focuses on the shooting of three black men at the Algiers Motel in Detroit, which happened during the riots. That's not a secret what happened. Now, what really happened with those shootings remains kind of murky to this day because there were a lot of witness accounts. There was a trial afterwards, which I'm not going to tell people, you know, what happened with that trial. I think you need to go to it, even though it is a real thing. The Algiers Motel incident and the ensuing interrogation really is the centerpiece of the film, and that's extremely well done, Doug. It goes on and on and on the film as well. John Boyega is probably the name actor in this film. He plays a security guard who works across the street from the motel. Boyega is a black actor, and so he's caught up in this turmoil with these white police officers from the Detroit Police Department who are suffice it to say, their interrogation tactics are suspect. They're very aggressive. They're trying to get confession out of who may have shot at National Guard troops from the motel. And it's still disputed to this day, Doug, whether anybody shot anything or if it was a toy gun. Anthony Mackie from the Avengers films plays a Vietnam veteran who's at the hotel. He gets interrogated as well. But the performance of the film is really by Will Poulter as the kind of ringleader of the cops, a very racist, out-of-control cop. Poulter played Jim Bridger in The Revenant, and he's really good in this film. Phenomenal performance in the movie. So those are the three kind of main performances. The film is strongest when it's at the motel, Doug. That's when you almost feel like you're a hostage. All these people being interrogated, including two young white women who are there at the motel, which is largely populated by African-Americans, that's an interesting dynamic. And if you think because they're white, they're going to kind of get away with things here, think again. The things spiral out of control very quickly. And Bigelow has a real gift for shooting those kind of things. The film is weakest, Doug, the beginning and the end. Without getting into too much detail of the end, it's sort of this tacked-on coda that I don't think quite works with the rest of the film. And the beginning starts with an animated sequence, which is a little preachy and a little strange. It doesn't really go with the rest of the film. I don't think it's as strong as her two previous big ones, Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. It's well edited. It's well put together, but it's not quite in that Hurt Locker, Zero Dark Thirty, you know, near masterpiece level.
It takes place during a tumultuous time in American history. These are the riots, the Detroit mm-hmm. riots, and a lot of the city just burned
yes.
During that event. So how does it deal with that part of the story?
So the beginning of the film, you get a lot of how the riots start. There's also, let me mention, Doug, a kind of a side story on a music group called the Dramatics, which is actually a real group, and they're kind of caught in the middle of this as well. So we get multiple plot lines, multiple people involved in the riots. Those scenes are very well done, Doug, and Bigelow actually does not spare some commentary about African Americans burning their neighborhoods down. That's in there as well. So I think it's a fairly even-handed account of, yes, there's blame to go around with how the police handled it. And then there's kind of this, why would people burn their neighborhoods down and loot their own stores? So that's covered as well, which I thought was fairly interesting. So it's not a completely one-sided view of what caused the riots and the ensuing aftermath. Like I said, Doug, I think the weak part of the film are the beginning and the end. The middle is very good. And the film could have been about 20 minutes shorter, Doug. It really goes on probably a little too long.
And this director has worked with this writer before.
Yes, they've collaborated on all three of the films that I have mentioned. Exactly.
So let's talk about a little Oscar trivia here, mm-hmm. since this is a movie I'm going to go to.
Okay. I do recommend it, Doug. I don't know if it'll still be kind of Oscar bait by the end of the year. We'll have to see. Bigelow is well-liked by the Academy, though.
Well, I Googled Detroit in the movies, and a big, long list came up, of course. Stuff like RoboCop
yeah.
and Transformers, interestingly enough, initially set in Detroit. But one movie in the 21st century actually won an Oscar that was set in Detroit. What was that movie, and what was the Oscar for?
Ooh, boy, that's a tricky one.
It is a tricky one.
You're making me work
this
week.
It's a semi-autobiographical film.
Semi-autobiographical.
Starring a well-known singer at the time.
Oh, Eminem, for the song from the film. What was the name of the film?
It was 8 Mile.
8 Mile, yes. He won the Best Song Oscar.
And it was Lose Yourself was the
Lose
name
yourself,
of the song.
Yes.
You were right. We've been to the movies
okay.
with Matt O'Lee.
Some Environmental Protection Agency employees have left under President Trump. Gina McCarthy wants them to stay.
So I understand that they feel the mission of the agency is not being served, but no, it's not okay for them to leave.
The former administrator of the EPA reacts to recent policy changes and all the latest news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 11th. Summer, for some, includes tennis. The thwack of a racket has echoed in North Dakota since the mid-1880s when lawn tennis infiltrated the region. Grand Forks organized its tennis club in 1885, and by the first decade of the 1900s, North Dakota had established state championships for individuals and doubles. On this date in 1904, the Grand Forks Herald reported that Julian Charles Monette, a lawyer from Candu, age 35, had won the singles championship at the Grand Forks Town and Country Club tennis grounds. Monette defeated Theodore Elton in three straight sets. Monette had also won the year before when the 1903 championship was held in Fargo. Mr. Monette was a wiry man with a tennis champion's body, standing 5 feet 7 inches tall and weighing 175 pounds. Born in Iowa in 1868, Monette had been educated as a lawyer at the University of Iowa. He then came to North Dakota to practice law, first to Bathgate in 1893, then Langdon in 1895, and finally Candu in 1901. Monette was such a good tennis player that he was not only the state champion of North Dakota, but also became the singles champion of Iowa and Illinois. However, Julian Monette's career in the legal profession surpassed even his tennis prowess. In 1905, shortly after winning his second North Dakota championship, he returned to the University of Iowa with his wife, Helen, and their three children. There, he obtained a master's degree in law, followed by further study at Harvard, earning a second law degree in 1908. Following a short stint as a professor of law at George Washington University, Monette accepted a call from the University of Oklahoma to establish a school of law at its campus in Norman in 1909. It was at the University of Oklahoma where Julian Monette became a renowned statewide figure. For 32 years, he served as dean of the law school. The law building was named Monette Hall in his honor. J.C. Monette retired from his university duties in 1941 and was swiftly inducted into Oklahoma's Hall of Fame. He died in 1961 at age 83. His North Dakota connections have been largely forgotten, but his legacy as a tennis champion from Candu may henceforth and evermore live on. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Monday on Main Street, Dr. Judy Orloff says a bad mood is contagious. On Monday, we'll share some advice from her book, The Empath Survival Guide, Life Strategies for Sensitive People. And 360 Review is a magazine published by the University of Mary. And in the current issue, Brenda Tufte, who's an administrator there, looks into a downward trend in academic performance among young men. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday. We hope you'll also check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.